haystack time. Or at least floating rat in giant rat-infested dock time. I went home feeling a little defeated. But on the journey back, my phone pinged to life with an email. It was from a man named John Horsey, a legendary fishing guide who led trips to Chew during the Pike Trials. If you'd already been lucky enough to snare a ticket, of course. I'd contacted him a few weeks before the great phone-in, but there didn't seem any point following up, given I hadn't managed to get a ticket. The email read, "Hi Will, just to let you know there are guided boats available on the 5th, 7th and 16th of February with me as the guide. This is a new initiative by Bristol Water. If you want one of these boats, then ring Chew ASAP. Kind regards, John Horsey." Frantically, I hammered the now very familiar number for the lodge. No answer. I left a voicemail, wrote an email, and tried to get through four more times before finally, mercifully, I heard that glorious West Country accent once more. "Hello, Chew Lakes." The words of my request spilled from my mouth at such a pace I was surprised the man on the end of the receiver could even figure out what I was trying to say. "Oh, I'm not sure." I could hear some riffling of papers in the background. Possibly they are all booked out. Possibly there is one left. I tried to sound cool, but it was pretty difficult given how badly I wanted this to work out. My heart was firmly in my mouth as the riffling continued, backdrop with the occasional, "Hmm." Eventually he answered, "Yep, one left, 16th of February 2016, my date with Pike Fishing Destiny." It was more money than I'd spent on a single day's fishing in my entire life, but I was over the moon. I had my ticket, and I was absolutely determined to make the very most out of it. All my ethics about chasing pounds and ounces and being part of a pike fishing circus were firmly buried. I was boarding the clown car with a front row seat for the big top and the undisputed ringmaster for hire. I just prayed we had a run of good weather. The days quickly passed and I started to feel increasingly nervous. A feeling of inadequacy I hadn't felt since I was listening to Dad in the stairwell started to creep into the back of my mind. Am I actually up to these fish? I opted to spend yet more of my dwindling savings on tackle, bigger lures, and a beefy braided line that felt like woven rope. Extraordinary reports from Chew began to filter in. By all accounts, this was shaping up to be one of the best February pike trials of all time. By the time my big day eventually came around, 20 pike over the 30-pound barrier had already been snared, with two truly enormous fish topping out the scales at 41 pounds. To give that some sort of perspective, Martin Bowler, one of the best all-round anglers in Britain, who also just happens to be John Wilson's nephew, landed a 34-pound 12-ounce fish and commented to the Angling Times, "If I caught that fish at any other venue, it would be a safe bet that it would be the best of the day. But I think the day I was fishing, it was only third biggest." One man even commented on Chew's Pike Fishing Facebook group that he wasn't sure if it was even worth him posting a picture of his fish, as it was only 28 pounds. 28 pounds! 6 pounds bigger than my biggest all-time pike. Not even worth posting. I spooled up my strongest reel with my all-new braided line and selected the three most powerful rods I own from the garden shed. I remember a fishery scientist saying to me, "A pike doesn't know how big he is." I thought that was a silly thing to say, but actually it isn't, is it? It's not like they've got a mirror to look in, is it? I liked John Horsey immediately. He was a bright, liberal man with an exceptional knowledge and enthusiasm for his sport. His heart lay with fly fishing, particularly in competitions where he'd captained England at world and European levels, and he'd even won the World Championships back in 2009. However, unlike many professional fly fishermen, he wasn't the sort of person who would turn his nose up at course fishermen purely on principle. Plus, he'd had a 40-pound pike to his boat, caught remarkably on a fly. For all of that, I was extremely grateful. His point regarding the pike in the mirror was that big fish don't necessarily change their feeding habits just because they are big fish. They are able to take bigger baits, of course, but it is prudent not to assume their diet exclusively matches their size. Almost every animal is still partial to the food it grew up on, and therefore you shouldn't be surprised if, every once in a while, you encounter a fish of far greater size than your diminutive bait would expect. The biggest carp I've ever caught simply swallowed a single kernel of sweet corn. Everyone always says it has to be a heavily stocked trout water to break a record. Well, there's plenty of big trout for the big pike to eat. But I don't believe that's strictly true, explained John. With his shock of white hair hidden beneath a baseball cap and neatly trimmed goatee beard, he had an air of the rock star about him. Chew is the best pike fishery in Britain today, because the levels of biodiversity here are exceptional. It's not just the pike. Everything in this water is big. Big trout, big tench, big eels, big roach. It's all thanks to the rich aquatic insect life that lives and breeds here. He cast out an arm across the water in front of us. Especially the black chironomids. The pike here are full of them. I had to look up chironomid later. Essentially, they're a variety of midge and closely resemble small mosquitoes, but don't let that put you off. This species is non-biting, and according to the Natural History Museum, they are a vitally important indicator species of the health of any water. They are extremely sensitive to any kind of pollutant or acidity in water, so their presence in numbers is a good sign of a first-rate environment. Fantastic news to fish of all sizes, from giant pike to minute stickleback, which readily gorge on the flies in their larva. John mentioned an autopsy on a mid-sized dead pike that revealed a stomach literally crammed with these small jet-black insects. And my friends who had fly-fished Chew in the past claimed to have actually seen the pike scooping the insects right out of the lake, breaching the surface like packs of dolphins. Chew is just that sort of place, where accepted logic is warped to such a degree that you genuinely start to believe in miracles. The lake looked truly serene at first light and sight. A clear, deep blue morning had left a light ripple, and a blanket of wispy fog was playing on the water's surface. Chew dwarfed the Cardiff docks, of course. It appeared oceanic in comparison, but it wasn't as intimidating as I'd thought it might be. As I perused the map on the back of my fishing permit, I noted it resembled a hen's chick in profile, albeit with a slightly oversized head. There were a few attractive-looking bays, a pair of trench-like legs, and a large island placed somewhere around the eye of the bird. Lots of potential fish-holding areas that broke up the immensity of the venue then. With John, I was far from fishing blind at any rate. He purposefully hung back to see where all the other boats would go. Pike fishing would be a bit like sheep, he declared, placing his tackle in the bottom of the boat. They all tend to go where big fish have been caught that week. They'll follow each other around throughout the day. It's always best to give them all a wide berth and find your own place to start. There's no rush anyway. The best time on this lake is often late afternoon to the sunset. John elected to start just left of Wick Green Point, a slight protrusion on the far bank from the lodge, somewhere around the centre of the chick's back. It was lined with a thick growth of reeds that had been bleached a starchy white in the winter air. Instinctively, I would have taken our boat right in amongst those reeds, looking for a take from a pike hidden up against the beds. This, I learnt, would not have found me a record. These are big, open-water fish, explained John. They don't even know the meaning of the word ambush. The average depth here is only about 13 feet, so quite shallow. You've got to get the bait down there to catch the really big ones. They won't come up to it, especially not when it's cold like this. They are immensely fat and immensely lazy. I picked up the pair of lures that I had bought brand new for this trip and handed them over to John for inspection. They felt sticky, like they were fresh out of the mould, and were utterly free of blemishes or experience. I was like a young boy on his first day at secondary school, conscious that my sparkling new pencil case was missing the requisite band insignias, amorous messages, or pictures of cocks, which all the older, far cooler boys seemed to have. One of the lures was a perfect replica of a small trout. I thought, given this was a trout lake, that was a fair choice. The second was a luminescent-looking perch, like the fish had spent its day swimming around nuclear fallout before finally making its way to my tackle box. I couldn't imagine what would draw me towards that one. It looked hideous. John eyed them both up before giving me something of a damning verdict. Well, I wouldn't go with that perch, Will. Not right away, anyway. And the pike won't recognise that as a rainbow trout, either. They've never seen a rainbow trout under £2 in this place. I hadn't even made my first cast, and I was already on the back foot. John, perhaps sensing I felt a little downcast, revisited the trout. They might just take it thinking it's a roach, though. It is very white. And after all you need in this lake is just one take. That was good enough for me. I hooked it up to a strong wire trace and took a deep breath. It'd taken an awful lot just to get to this point. I cast out well away from the reeds, watched my braided line snake out a little before feeling the lure strike the lake's bottom. John was right, it really was shallow. I began my retrieve, keeping it slow, steady and tight to the bed, as instructed. This was it. I was finally fishing Chew. 5 minutes later, I felt the telltale thump and headshake of a predator. A brief but solid fight brought an impeccable little pike of about 4 pounds to the edge of the boat. It was a nerve settler, the piscatorial equivalent of a pre-match pep talk, and there was even a small but satisfactory tear in the side of my new trout now. Perhaps I was worthy after all. Soon afterwards, a spiteful wind picked up off the Mendip Hills, rocking our boat and biting sharply into my bare hands. Of course, Chew wasn't going to let me have it all my own way. We pulled up our anchor and headed for shelter behind a large semi-flooded island. Blimey, John, there's plenty of boats down here. A quick head count revealed well over half of all the boats on the lake were also taking refuge, strung out in a long line like the floating buoys of a giant gillnet. I blew some hot air into my hands. Don't be fooled, mate. They're not down here just to stay warm, said John, with a quiet intensity. This was where that 41-pound giant was caught last week. He selected a very, very large, fresh-looking mackerel from his bait box and fixed it firmly to a treble hook. I know, because I was here. He cast the mackerel right out into the middle of the channel and tightened down his line till his fat, red-top float could be seen bouncing happily along the surface. I settled into a trance-like state, casting my lure, retrieving, focusing in on the play of the line through the water, and arching my neck occasionally to check how floats were still in place. A curious sensation came over me. It was a feeling that comes along with such infrequency that it feels like a sort of temporary psychosis, yet it strikes with such undeniable force that it is impossible to ignore. As sure as King Canute knew he could not really turn the tides, I became convinced the pike were coming on to feed. "We're going to get a fish here, John," I said, venturing to vocalise my forecast, in spite of the lack of any discernible evidence. It was a gut instinct, a primeval intuition, long since buried beneath several thousand generations of comfortable living and comfort eating. But I was utterly convinced I was right. One of the men on the string of boats suddenly stood bolt upright with a rod buckling in his hand. I knew it. We watched as his boat partner threw a massive black net from port to starboard, like a man wrestling with some giant sail on an ocean-going clipper. The angler started to pump the fish towards him. The tide was turning against this pike. Soon it was subdued somewhere down by the engine block. They shook hands. It was a good one, at least 20 pounds in weight. My float is doing something funny. Instantly I snapped my gaze from the drama unfolding the other boat. John was staring out at his float, which was now beginning to wheel. When I was 16, I learnt how big pike can often feed in spells. I remember that day clearly, my legs whirring as I ran away from the riverbank and back towards Grandad's bungalow. Behind me, submerged in a net, I had left a pike. A proper one, not a small jack or an emaciated summerfish, but a fat female that almost tore my rod into the deep alongside my smelt dead bait. The fish in itself was remarkable, but of far greater significance was the other, even bigger pike that lay in the net right beside it. In just 10 minutes, I had smashed my personal best, twice. I was in pike fishing nirvana, and I pray Grandma had film in her camera as I exploded into the kitchen. Grandma took my photo with both fish. "Well done, boy," shouted Grandad, giving me the thumbs up I'd hoped for. He was off to play carpet bowls, he said. Fishing in the bleak midwinter wasn't really his thing. I knew that was a special day. Over 30 pounds of pike in just 2 casts. Sometimes, I feel I've been paying for that piece of good fortune ever since. John's float started kiting hard to the left. This really was it. "You take it." John pulled the rod from its rest and handed it down to me in an act of extraordinary generosity. "Really? Are you sure?" I stuttered. And we had a brief and ridiculously British standoff at the absolute critical moment. "Yes, go for it, Will," he eventually shouted, imploring me to take the rod. I didn't need to be asked for a third time. I reeled up the slack line, sank the tip and swept the rod upwards. But there was nothing. No riposte. No bone-churning heavyweight thump. Just air and slack. I reeled down once more and gave it another slam, but it was useless. The pike had already let go. That was the big mackerel bait, wasn't it? I asked, half hoping John might answer in the negative, or just assure me it was possible a trout could have chewed the bait from the hook. Yes, Will. My chance had been and gone. As plausible as it is that a 40-pound pike might feed on a tiny chironomid, there was no way a small fish was ever squeezing a 1-pound mackerel bait down its gullet. As quickly as the feeding spell had been triggered, the big pike turned themselves off once more. There was excited chatter among the boats as we pulled into the docks that sunset. A Chew employee placed a thick boot on the side of our boat as we drifted into the melee. "There were 7:30s out today, lads," he revealed gleefully. "How did you guys get on?" The van's windscreen wipers squealed as I fought with the drizzle on the drive back home. I wonder how big that fish really was. I'll never know now, of course, but I felt oddly calm. When I was a boy, I recall Grandad telling me a story about a great fish he had once hooked that ran with an unstoppable force until it emptied his reel of 100 meters of line and eventually broke free, leaving his rod hanging limp like a washing line cracked in a storm. I asked him to recall this anecdote many times, both because I loved the idea of the mysterious giant in our waters, but also because I was unable to process how he could recall such a tale of calamity and yet appear so at peace. Perhaps in the retelling his demeanour would one day buckle, betraying his true feelings of raw hurt and resentment, but of course it never did. Grandad, I realised now, was simply enriched by the experience of angling. His inner tranquility came from a confidence emboldened by the knowledge that when it comes to hooking a big fish, a degree of loss is simply inevitable. It was not something to resent or regret. It was simply an acceptable part of what it meant to be a true fisherman and a better person. I would return to Chew if I ever get the chance again, but for all the ticketing process, the beefed up tackle, circumstance and ceremony, could I reasonably say my day today had brought me more pleasure than the pike I'd caught in the canal? Perhaps anglers' success is not determined only by the sheer size of the fish they catch, but the manner of, and pleasure to be had from, the pursuit and chase. It had taken me over 20 years to learn the wisdom Grandad was once trying to impart, but I understood in the end. I would turn my attentions to fish of smaller proportions for the rest of this fishing year, and leave the giants for another time and place. It was almost the close of the winter of 92 before I caught my first pike. As is often the way with these things, the fight of my fears was over before it began. My spinner approached a hole within a cluster of reeds, and a small pike materialised hot on its heels. I hastened my retrieve, and the fish, believing its meal was about to escape, near launched itself out of the water to engulf the lure. Of all the pike I have caught, it was by far the easiest to land. I hooked it less than a foot from the bank and simply sprinted backwards, tearing the fish clean from the water and almost getting run over by a passing car in the process. Unfortunately, behind the wheel was my year 4 primary school teacher, Mrs. Hills. I could tell I was in for a massive rollicking by the steam coming from her brakes and ears, so I quickly scooped up my pike and sprinted off before she could even lay a hand on her car door handle. It didn't occur to me then that this fish was merely a juvenile, or that I'd been extremely lucky not to lose it or snap my line with my terrible antics. As far as I was concerned, I now had living, breathing proof that Dad and Grandad were not always right. Pike were extremely hard to catch, but I did have the strength to do it on my own. In a quiet, teacher-free corner of the creek, I slipped my little pike back into the shallows. I couldn't possibly have realised it at the time, but as it kicked its tail to disappear once and for all, it was taking a vital piece of my childhood down into the murk with it. A never-ending golden sun. Early June in Britain has a definite smell. It's not quite the sharp relief that you might associate with the first shoots of spring. A sliced crabapple that's fallen straight off the tree, maybe. Or a sudden rain shower on crisp grass, perhaps. But it isn't anything like the sweaty oppression of a hot summer's day either, which hovers somewhere between a damp gym sock and an overripe banana. Early June is much more subtle than that. It's a gradual sweetening of the air, an almost honey-like scent that creeps out across the land and rolls out a yellowing haze in its wake. It is experienced especially well at dawn by the side of a pond, when it can feel like the whole country is being gently dusted with a caramelized sugar crust, simply for your pleasure. All that you've been viewing the land through a pair of ginger-coloured stockings that are pulled tight right across the balls of your eyes. When early June is on form, it brings the humans warily to their gardens to cook meat and attempt some ice in their drinks, and also calls bees out of their hive to gather and discuss making a move. Don't be fooled, though. Early June brings a sense of threat, too. It is not yet summer, and all that has built since winter could quite easily be swept aside in a solitary night of single-digit temperatures, or a week of sullen rain. It is a risk that only doubles if someone is foolish enough to remark, "What wonderful weather we've been having recently." For me, and anglers like me, early June exists as a hidden fifth season. It's not always found in early June. It can actually be any time from May, or even as early as late April, if we have had an exceptionally warm spring. Throwing our increasingly irrelevant Gregorian calendar aside, it is more accurate to place this season somewhere between the point the bluebells pass their best and the 7 days of proper sun we call summer. It brings trout to the surface to feed voraciously on the first of the serious flyhatches, a time known as Duffer's Fortnight, where even the most novice of anglers could seemingly catch a fish with a bent pin. But it is early morning on a certain type of water, targeting a certain type of fish, that defines the hidden season for some of us. If you are lucky enough to catch this bridging spell at its climax, then it is as close to climatic perfection as I think it is possible to experience as a fisherman. To achieve true flawlessness, though, is to time these rarefied atmospherics with your presence beside a lily-choked and tree-lined pool at the exact point of sunrise. Obviously, you'll need a rod loaded with light line and a bright float. Preferably, there will also be a billowing steam peeling off the water's surface. And once you've made your first cast, great plumes of pinhead-sized bubbles will surround your patch of water in a fizzing carpet. If there is an angling scene that better represents the quintessence of this unsung time of year, then I am yet to see it. But the fish that leads the charge doesn't just show itself to anyone. You have to be willing to search. It was the start of the summer holidays from school, my first in secondary education, and Grandad was searching furiously at the back end of his living room. His arse had just nearly knocked the television over. "Yes, I've got it," he shouted in triumph while lifting an old Polaroid cleanly from the labyrinth of VHS cassettes and family albums. He resembled an immense old walrus emerging from the water with a fresh fish in its teeth. It was a black and white photo showing a solid-looking young man kicking a rugby ball. His shoulders are leaning back, his spine is straight, and the ball has just been thumped so hard it is leaving his toe as nothing more than an egg-shaped blur. Grandad restored his breath. "There, Will." He presents me with the image while inhaling, this time for dramatic effect. "The perfect kick. You'll never see it done better than that." He thumbs the photo to make his point. "That is how you do it, my boy." I grip it in my hands. It's him in the picture, isn't it? Of course it's him. Things hadn't gone too well at my new school. The endless evenings of fishing after lessons were over for a start. Homework and a long journey to and from the gates have made sure of that. Plus, after 7 years of climbing the year groups at the local village primary school, I'd found myself unceremoniously dumped back at the very bottom of the pecking order. It wasn't like Wisbeach Grammar was all that bad. I was bullied, but not terribly so. It was the brand of schoolboy cruelty that had you tying a coin into the knot of your tie, to stop it being pulled so tight it was impossible to undo, rather than the threat of actual bodily harm. But having any sort of fear of attending school was new to me, and I didn't like it at all. This was the start of adult life, though, where the first lesson you learn is that your free time will be leased back to you only once you've earned it, and that your future now depends on your ranking within an extremely narrow field of disciplines. In lieu of stellar grades, I was no academic. I was to be judged by my ability to hit a cricket ball and take a full contact rugby tackle. The problem was, I was terrible at both rugby and cricket. We'd played neither at my primary school, bar the very occasional game with a softball or tag rugby, where the worst thing that could happen is that your mate grabs your shorts and not your tag, and you end up exposing yourself to the class. Unfortunately, there really isn't much room for fishing in the arena of competitive team sports, especially those played by adolescent boys. Sure, there is a match angling scene, but mostly this still boils down to individuals performing against other individuals, and no one, I repeat no one, has pictures of the latest match angling stars plastered across their bedroom walls. Anglers just aren't idols or icons for your normal teenager. My obsession with John Wilson suddenly seemed very childish, and, to be frank, a bit embarrassing. My recent progression as an angler was an irrelevance to my new classmates, of course. No one cared how good my casting was getting, or that I'd recently broken my perch personal best. Instead, my fishing became my escape route, the secret place I could vanish into to hide from my struggles at school. Later, angling would actually offer me something of a pathway out of my problems, but that was all to come, and in the first year of the new school, I simply had no choice but to play the sports they instructed me to play. I couldn't even catch a cricket ball, let alone throw it. They were rock hard and frightening, much like the teachers and older kids who pushed past me in the corridor, and as such, I tried to avoid them, all of them, at any cost. "You're a bit of a loner, aren't you?" remarked one of my peers after yet another lunchtime of dodging the other pupils in the first year. I felt hot tears puddling in my eyes and quickly looked away. "No, you're just all dickheads," I wish I could have said. Dad and I were sat together in the Rose Tavern pub at the end of the school year. He was a massive real ale nerd, so going to pubs was hardly something new. Even as a 12-year-old, I'd seen the inside of most of the decent pubs in our area, especially if they graced the hallowed pages of the Camera Good Beer Guide. But it was a rare occurrence to be alone with him and without the rest of the family. I was finally sat in the inner sanctum, the actual bar and not just the family fun zone, in with the real men who drank by the pint, smoked and swore. I thought for a moment that Dad might even buy me a beer. But really, I knew the real reason why I was here. I'd just experienced the sporting equivalent of being tarred, feathered, and marched around the market square naked. It was time for a fatherly pep talk. He slid an orange juice across the table towards me. "It will get better. Give it time, Will." I felt too sick to even drink it. He had to give it time at his school, he explained, and it wasn't easy for him either, at first. "It actually took me right till sixth form before I really started enjoying it," he attempted, jovially. "Sixth form? Was Dad absolutely out of his mind? That was 6 years away." I looked at the orange juice in front of me and wished my whole life would go away. My first rugby season had been a complete and utter disaster. It began with quite possibly the most anonymous performance in rugby union history, where the one touch of the ball I had was the moment it collided with my face and split open my nose, and ended, even more dramatically, when one of the teachers used my limp form to demonstrate the dump tackle and shattered my collarbone in the process. Sadly, my collarbone had refused just in time for the cricket season, but, unlike the X-Men, it had not mutated into anything that might have given me superpowers or even just a better throw. The year's crowning glory, truly the fly on this absolute turd of a term, had occurred just an hour before Dad's morale-boosting speech in the pub. The under-12 first-team cricketers were a man down, and as I'd volunteered to do the scoring in the ludicrously misguided parental belief that it's all about taking part, I was drafted in as the 11th player. I spent our opponent's innings just trying to avoid the ball, a feat I achieved well by virtue of the fact my team wanted me nowhere near the ball either. But when it came to our turn to bat, my luck ran clean out. Wickets tumbled with regularity from almost the moment our batsmen began their run chase. They had a bowler with an arm like Hercules, who, quite remarkably, also appeared to have grown some facial hair. I could only assume this man-boy was part of some witness protection program, sent to terrorize the under-12 cricket scene in relative anonymity. Stumps explode into puffs of sawdust, and all too soon I found I was strapping myself into every single piece of protective equipment the school owned. I was sure I was going to die at the crease, and 10 minutes later, I realised I had. All I needed to do for our team to escape the debacle with a draw was to bat for 3 balls. 3 balls. The first fizzed past my head. I didn't even see it. Hercules glowered at me. "He isn't moving," I heard an ignoramus shout from within my own team, who, I noted, had helpfully gathered in a 10-man semicircle around the boundary rope, as if they were witnessing an execution by stoning. The second ball swung away, just inches from shattering my fingers, or worse, my stumps. Everyone groaned. Hands were placed on heads on both sides. "Just one more left," I thought to myself. I looked to my dad, off work for the game, but never really a sporting man either. He tried to give me an encouraging thumbs-up look from behind his glasses and improbably thick hair, but his face betrayed his true feelings. I was in deep shit. With sad inevitability, the third and final ball crumpled my wicket. You could have heard my teammates on Mars as I trudged off the pitch. "Fucking useless Millard. We should never have sent him out there." A darkness descended. I scooped up my bag and headed for Dad's car in the Rose Tavern pub, without speaking a single word till I was wedged in the triple sanctuary of a Toby mug, a fruit machine, and my dad. "They totally blame me, Dad. You heard what they said. How can I show my face in school after that?" I was ranting at my juice. "I hate this place. I hate this school. I hate everything about it. All of my primary school friends went to Downham. I just don't understand why I'm here in this place with these blazers and rules and teachers and tests and terrible sports and not with all my friends." I started to cry properly this time. Dad put a hand on my shoulder. "If you still hate it at the end of next year, we'll move you out. I promise." I sniffed hard and plunged my wet face into his shirt. "Give it time," he said again. I could tell it was hurting him too, but I didn't care.
"But what about rugby season next year, Dad?" I shouted. "They'll kill me!"
He looked at me with glassy brown eyes and said nothing. The reason for Grandad's sudden expedition to the land that time forgot was that he had spoken to my dad and believed the solution to all of my problems was behind his television set. "All you need to do is study this picture and you'll be able to kick penalties from the centre spot." He slapped me so forcefully between the shoulder blades I felt the tremor in my stick-thin legs, like 2 albino chipolatas. There was no way that this was what Dad had advised Grandad to do. He'd come up with this solution all on his own.
"You've got all summer before the start of the rugby season. Just give it some beef, boy."
I looked up at him, hoping he could see through to the lost child within. There was a pause as he stooped to meet my gaze. Understanding dawning, perhaps.
"You can take it home and study it if you like." He gave me a chummy wink and another slap on the back.
I didn't take it home. I had 8 weeks before I had to be back at that school, and I intended to spend it all forgetting the place ever existed. That meant 2 things, fishing and really big carp. By my final year of primary school, the memory of the first pike had faded. I had a clutch of close friends from the village whom I fish with, and together with our bikes and the timetable of the Norfolk Green bus, we were pushing further than ever before. Bigger drains for bigger fish, stronger rods, thicker lines, and the greater levels of patience required to sit through the shoals of roach and perch for something really special. With them I caught my first zander, our first proper pike, my first ever chub, all by strapping rods to the crossbars of our bikes and pedalling as far as our legs could carry us in a single day. We were the kings of the fens, bound only by the parental rule that we must be home by nightfall, and by the end of our time together in school, our angling ambitions were inevitably extending beyond what we could feasibly catch from our home waters. We wanted more, and we weren't alone. From the late 1970s onwards, anglers nationwide were draining from Britain's rivers and canals and taking their tackle to well-stocked and exceptionally well-polished commercially motivated fisheries. Overwhelmingly, the explosive popularity of one single species had driven the change, the king carp. It had first been introduced from Asia as food for monks during the Middle Ages, and selective breeding has seen the proliferation of a heavier, hardier, and highly varied cyprinid species that combined a readiness to feed with a heart-stoppingly powerful fight from even the smallest specimens.
There was hardly a pond in the UK that they couldn't be stocked in, and with astronomical annual weight gain possible from a new wave of protein-rich baits, targeting the species passed from the specialist and into the hands of the everyman. Images of these giant fish, with their magnificent scale patterns, implausibly broad guts and thick, rounded mouths, screamed from the front page of every fishing magazine and tackle shop in the country. Even John Wilson was far from immune to carp fever. He built a carp lake in his own back garden and soon released a video titled Oliver's First Carp, in which a boy exactly our age caught a single fish that weighed more than our entire annual catch from the creek. That was enough for us, and what remained of that summer was spent begging our parents to drive us out to our closest commercial carp lake. I have hardly ever felt as ill-prepared as the day we eventually arrived on the banks at Wood Lakes in Stowbridge. This wasn't fishing as we knew it. It was war. Row upon row of stiff carbon fiber rods sat on tripods backed onto high-tech bite alarms, like a battery of anti-aircraft missiles, and behind each rig sat a grizzled-looking angler dressed head-to-toe in camouflage gear. Even the baits were unrecognisable. Brightly coloured balls called boilies that looked more like sweets than an edible fish attractant. But, my God, these setups were effective. Every so often a bite alarm would scream off and one of the men would lift nonchalantly into the sort of fish that would have had us talking for months. We stood in silence and watched the carnage. It was all we could do. Our rods, cobbled together collection of tackle, and mum-made foil-wrapped sandwiches were pathetic in comparison. When we eventually did attempt to fish, we hid away in the far corner of the lake and took to plundering our way through the shoal of tiny perch that lived there. It had to be tiny perch, didn't it? Despite all the fish we had caught together in months past, we were now thrown to the minnows of our adolescence. That one morning in the company of the kings of carp had proven we were still just little boys after all, and I wasn't actually the king of anything. Things just got worse from that point. I would be even more aware of my shortcomings the following summer, thanks to cricket at my new school, but of even greater concern that year was the discovery that I was no longer surrounded by my friends. In big boy school, I was just another fluff-faced, squeaky-voiced competitor, lining up in a bizarre, hormone-driven race without rules or a discernible finishing line. Quite quickly, catching a big carp became the embodiment of my teenage frustrations. It was my fantasy fish, the one creature capable of bridging the gap between my shortcomings as an angler and my teenage aspirations, and meant so much more to me than just ticking off another species in the Wilson Encyclopedia. For me, it was puberty. If only I knew then what I know now, I might not have been so eager to commit myself fully to commercial carp fishing at such a young age. My friends and I were very late to the party. It was the early 1990s by the time we graced the banks of Wood Lakes, by which point the nature of commercial carp fishing had been refined to such an extent that it felt like the whole fishscape might well have spilled off the back of the same truck. Identikit lakes, fish and fishermen spread out across the land, reducing the sport to catching as big or as much with as little effort as humanly possible. Well-maintained fishing platforms replaced wild holes in the reeds, flattened roads led direct to well-manicured banks, and, in many places, fishing swims were dragged entirely clean of debris, detritus, or any other snags that could result in a lost carp and a spoiled day. For the most part, any native wildlife that could be seen to have any detrimental impact on carp growth in the carp pond was actively discouraged or ruthlessly controlled. At the fisheries that could afford them, otter-proof fences were erected, cormorants, the Black Death, were managed or just shot, and so-called nuisance fish species, bream, roach, rudd and tench, were netted en masse and removed altogether. The key to success is to ensure the customer's hook baits always have the very best chance of working their way to the lips of a specimen carp, and specimen carp only. Chris Yates, an angling legend and staunch traditionalist who famously broke the British carp record in 1980 on an antique rod and single grain of corn, wrote a scathing attack on the direction of the sport in his brilliant 1997 book, The Secret Carp. "This standardization has gone beyond a joke. Not only do the majority of carp anglers have to fish with at least three identical rods and reels, they must also have the complete product range of whoever happens to be the most fashionable tackle and bait manufacturers of the day. And of course they also require waters that can accommodate this multi-rodded, heavily equipped, regimental approach. So the lakes have become standardized as well. Ultimately, even the fish have become standardized, with all specimens entered onto graphs which show growth ratios, condition factors, identification marks, color variations, dietary habits, intelligence ratings, dress sense, musical appreciation, and a knowledge of world history. He's being disingenuous, of course, but only slightly. Carp fishing today has arguably gone even further down the standardization road. On one side are the big fish venues with lightly stocked but named and well-known carp giants that might grace the bank several times in a season. And on the other are fish-filled carp factories that provide constant rod-bending action all year round. 30 years ago, a fishing catch totaling £100 or more would have been big news. But this season, a six-hour match was won by an angler who banked an astonishing £1,500 of carp. His haul amounted to 350 fish at a catch rate of one carp a minute, with the top three competitors also catching in excess of £1,000 of fish each as well. It amounted to over 1,900 carp out of that one lake in a single August afternoon. Given the Environment Agency recommends that natural fisheries can only hold 200 pounds of fish per acre to remain healthy, it is clear something is very definitely, very seriously wrong. No fisherman is that good. Fishing in this way places fish and fish welfare as firmly secondary to the demands of the angler. In the worst case scenario, the fish in these oxygen depleted and unnatural environments must eat the food we offer them just to survive. It's little more than Battle Royale or the Hunger Games of carp, fishing reduced to a game of numbers based wholly on a single species. It sounds awful, it really does, but for the past 20 years, I've absolutely lapped it up. This is in part because not all commercial fisheries are quite that bad, but also because they can be an enormous amount of fun. I get the attraction, I really do. When you haven't got much spare time to indulge in a hobby that has a tendency to be a slow burn on the best of days, sometimes you just want to catch. But this overpowering magnetism of the commercial lake has fundamentally altered fishing as we know it, and not for the better. For the majority of anglers today, there is simply no longer any alternative to the commercial. I had learned from the Canal and River Trust that many of our once great waterways had fallen into a state of neglect, purely through a total lack of angling interest, but I also recall John Ellis's comment that all the youth seek these days are thrills from bigger and bigger carp, and this, I discovered, doesn't necessarily keep them in our sport for life. This season's rod license sales show there is a huge lack of young people coming to fishing. Worse yet, junior licenses are down a massive 50% in just the last 5 years. The only growing branch of the sport today is among pensioners, the sorts of people who had grown up around massive canal matches and the understated pleasures to be had from dangling a worm in wild rivers and streams. In building up to the carp lakes through the small perch, roach and pike of my local river, I had already received a gradual apprenticeship in the essential techniques I needed. But I also formed a critically important and deeply intense connection to my natural environment. It just isn't the same if you jump straight into the sport and catch a lump from a stock pit at the very first time of asking. There's no question that carp fishing is extremely exciting, but the buzz wears thin if that's all you ever experience and catching something is guaranteed. It's hard to imagine many young people sticking with fishing once that box has been ticked multiple times, and I can't see them reverting to the subtle pleasures to be had from plundering small fry from a river either, especially once they've been hooked on the power of the carp. You can't blame the owners of the commercial fisheries. It's just business after all, and many have taken serious steps to set up in a manner that is better for the carp. But these waters shouldn't be to the exclusion of all other fishing styles and species. It is down to us, as a fishing community, to take responsibility for protecting the integrity of our sport by choosing to be more diverse with our angling. After all, Shouldn't fishing represent the exception, the foil, the buffer to a modern world already filled with uniformity, instant gratification, clickbait buzzes and shrinking attention spans? Angling by its very nature is a random, often chaotic collection of environments, species, methods and possibilities that afford the fisherman the opportunity to get utterly lost for a lifetime or more. You can't always win, but that doesn't mean you necessarily lose. Whatever next? Rods that reel the fish in for you? Or devices that cast your bait into the perfect spot? I didn't want to tell Grandad about the electronic bait boat I'd seen during my latest trip to Wood Lakes. It quite literally did cast that man's bait into the perfect spot. It's taking the skill out of fishing, he droned on and on. By the end of the summer, after that fateful first year at secondary school, my fishing friends from the village had drifted away. We'd caught a handful of small carp between us, and had swapped our river tackle and maggots for our own series of identical rods and bags of boilies. But the polarizing demands of our new schools in different towns had come between us in the end. We were all on different paths now, and I missed them a great deal. The biggest new challenge on my horizon was found within the new commercial carp fishery that just opened, ironically, at the end of Grandad's garden. I knew beyond doubt that I needed those carp more than ever now. Besides, it seemed more than just mere coincidence that big carp were available a stone's throw from Grandad's lobelias. This was my chance to fill the void left by friends and sporting failures, and it felt like it was being handed to me on a plate. I told Grandad we had to go. He just laughed, so I went on my own. It took a couple of weeks down there before it happened. I was fishing a bunch of maggots tight to the back of a purpose-built island feature when my rod was quite literally ripped clean off its rests and into the lake. I picked it up by its disappearing butt and began a fight like no other. The reel screamed and the rod hooped to breaking point as it tried in vain to cushion a thunderous opening run. It was far and away the biggest fish I had ever been connected to at the time. A fish I had long dreamt of, and a fight I had spent long hours practicing for and considering. But now it was all happening, I felt a sense of near paralyzing fear, both of what the fish might do to my tackle and what it'd do to my vulnerable emotional state if it managed to escape. Eventually, the great carp wallowed, hippo-like, directly under the rod tip. It was as if I was watching Wilson on a video of my childhood, laughing along and reaching for the net. But it wasn't him, it was me. I leant forward, waist high in the lake, with water seeping down deep into the fibres of my Umbro tracksuit bottoms, and folded the fish deep into my memory for all time. I'd caught a mirror carp, so named after the set of shining reflective scales that adorn its flanks. It tipped my scales at a hefty 12 pounds. Not massive by carp standards, but the restorative properties that fish had for my self-belief were worth a thousand centuries in cricket or a winning goal in the 93rd minute. If I could emulate my fishing hero, then what else couldn't I achieve? I was euphoric that night, and in a rush of blood to the head, asked Mum, our household's cricket impresario, if I could join the village cricket club. From now on, I would seek only bigger and bigger challenges, and I would take them head on. The capture of the mirror carp had bolstered my sense of self-belief to such an extent that I could almost imagine its immaculate scales were to be worn as plates in my own suit of armour. No one was going to make me feel scared or hopeless ever again, and I was going to get better at sport, even if it did kill me. In spring, I returned from a long period of filming in the jungles of New Guinea to find blissful sunshine bathing the nation. Finally, the horror rains of the endless winter had passed and the new season had brought some superb fishing weather. I'd wanted to catch crucians from the outset of this challenge, mostly because I thought they were among the most beautiful fish swimming in our waters. I still do. But I also hoped it would be a really good way of exploring the unsung traditional still waters of the nation. The sorts of places you might see in the paintings of the English Romantics. Very constable-esque, I imagined. But I also felt, after the drubbing at the hands of both the pike and the perch, that this was a fish I actually had a fairly good chance with. I'd caught a fair few crucians while out carp fishing, including one real beauty, almost 3 pounds in weight. So surely, with just a few tweaks to my tactics, and perhaps a bit of research, a whopper was well within my reach. I, along with many others, believed that the Crucian was native to Britain. Its pocket-sized and dignified appearance was surely more in keeping with these fair isles than the brutish king carp. However, I soon discovered this was not the case at all. The most recent DNA analysis of a sample in Norfolk can only place the Crucian here in the medieval period, around the same time as all the other carp species. I forgave myself for my mistake. The analysis was only a couple of years old and was hardly official. Even Alwyn Wheeler, fish expert and former curator of the Natural History Museum's fish department, had believed they were native, stating as much in his paper published in the year 2000. But there was still no way of getting round the cold, hard, present-day facts. This fish was introduced. Its being so much smaller than the king carp has led to suggestions that the Crucian might have been brought here from the east as something of an ornamental species, a splash of colour in the noble's pond. But it is hard to find precise references to support the supposition. What we do know is that carp as a whole were a much sought-after food item in the Middle Ages. Perhaps a multitude of carp species were actually ordered to create something of a smorgasbord for those with a piscatorial palate. Carp was no food for the peasantry, though. Maintained by monks and consumed by monarchs, carp were both luxury food items and status enhancers, favoured, in particular, by the House of Tudor. Who knows? Perhaps the rotund King Henry VIII was chewing down on his umpteenth Crucian while considering executing another wife. He certainly had a partiality for the carp species and practically every other freshwater fish in Britain. Suzanne Groom, in her book At the King's Table, Royal Dining Through the Ages, describes a magnificent starter course served to Henry VIII that naturally included carp, but also herring, cod, lampreys, pike, salmon, whiting, haddock, plaice, bream, porpoise, seal, trout, crabs, lobsters, custard, tart, fritters and fruit. And that doesn't even touch on the man's penchant for whale meat, black pudding and swans. It was curious, I thought, how all the other species to grace the tables and plates of the palace were so well distinguished and explicitly referenced. Yet when it came to the carp, everything from goldfish to commons, to crucians, fell under the same generic carp banner. I glossed over this detail at the time, but it was actually a sign of things to come. I thumbed through the Wilson Encyclopedia to the Crucian section. I noted his description of the unusual upturned mouth without barbels and tendency to shoal according to their size. But it wasn't until I came to cast my eye on the listed British record size that I stopped in my tracks. Something wasn't right. 5 pounds, 10.5 ounces. There was no way that could possibly be accurate. I knew for a fact that there was no verified Crucian catch in Britain in excess of 5 pounds. As, after I caught my 3-pounder, I checked the record books and discovered that the record back then was only around 4.5 pounds. But I just couldn't imagine Wilson making such an elementary mistake either. I was going to need some help. Peter Rolfe runs a wonderful website dedicated wholly to the species, www.crucians.org. And after a friendly exchange of emails, I tapped the digits of his number into the receiver, and a gravelly, almost Shakespearean voice soon answered the phone. "The sooner we drop carp from Crucian carp, the better," he growled. Peter Rolfe has been dedicated to the preservation of the Crucian for the past 40 years. He is a bona fide hero for the species, even receiving the Fred J. Taylor Award for Environmental Stewardship in acknowledgement of his work, but I doubt he'd ever wear such a title. "People think that the fish is related to the king carp when they hear that carp moniker, when of course it isn't. It's related to the goldfish." I scribbled furiously as he spoke. It was all news to me. "The bigger carp species outcompete Crucians for territory and food, so that's bad for one, but also they interbreed with them with tremendous ease, as does the very similar brown goldfish. As commercial fisheries and the stocking of king carp became popular everywhere, well, the humble Crucian didn't really stand much of a chance." In my 12-year-old haste to pivot on the scaly backs of king carp and hop into the world of real men, I didn't once stop to consider what the consequences of such a wholesale stocking program might be. By the end of the 1990s, it had become abundantly clear that the Crucian was actually in very real trouble indeed. It hadn't seemed so bad at first. I suppose it was just that they'd become less popular, continued Peter. But once we realised just how many fish that we thought were Crucians were in fact crossbreeds with goldfish or common carp, well, we realised the situation was somewhat dire. Peter was putting it delicately. If the Crucian wasn't marching to the brink of extinction in this country, it was certainly gearing up for the walk. It was a paradox of sorts, our obsession with the king carp speeding the decline of a different species of carp. But it was pretty easy to see why things had gone so wrong for the Crucian. It was small enough to be ignored. Little wonder it preferred the hidden season. As a fish of Britain, it was once dangerously close to vanishing altogether. The Wilson Encyclopedia puts a Crucian megaspecimen at over £3. That is chump change for the king carp, really a very average-sized fish. And with an angling population hooked on the bigger is better mantra, the Crucian was almost predestined for trouble. The odds were stacked further against the fish as their traditional habitat, small, rural pools, began to disappear nationwide through drought, pollution, and shifting agricultural practices. The Crucians might have stood something of a chance in an environment where a disappearing waterway would at least make local news, in small pools in our parks or urban ponds, for instance. But unfortunately, the well-intentioned communities here have a tendency to unwittingly liberate their pet goldfish directly into the Crucian gene pool. With that, it seemed to Peter and his friends at least, the Crucian's fate was sealed. Then came a quite unexpected turn in their fortunes. In 1997, the British Record Fish Committee hit the reset button on the whole Crucian record list. Following the crossbreeding revelations, it was felt the record as it stood was essentially redundant. No one could be sure if the leading fish were pure Crucians or just crossbreed hybrids with goldfish and common carp. Clear rules were set out to help the layperson identify the fish. Between 32 and 34 scales along the lateral line, a lack of barbels around the mouth, a large convex dorsal fin. And a new fishing challenge was laid down to an army of anglers, apparently itching for something new. One year later, the capture of a truly enormous 4-pound, 2-ounce pure Crucian lit up the angling press, and the wider fishing public, surprisingly, switched onto this diminutive fish wholesale. Perhaps the king carp-shaped blinkers were gradually being lifted as the new millennium approached, but either way, as the tragic plight of the fish made the national press, the call to do much more to save the Crucian reached an unprecedented level. Things were quite suddenly much more optimistic for the Crucian. Peter warmed at the thought. The word has since spread, and many more people are interested in fishing for them these days. Really, I'm chuffed it's all happening. The Wilson Encyclopedia had hit the shelves and my granddad's own Henry VIII-esque stomach in 1995. Wilson, like the rest of us, simply didn't realise these carp were all separate species with a truly extraordinary ability to crossbreed. There is a lot of misinformation out there about the fish still, ponds and fisheries claiming to hold the Crucian, when really they don't. And also fish breeders who think they're selling pure Crucians, when in fact they are goldfish or common carp hybrids. You can see online, people still think they're catching near record Crucians, when in fact they are all just crossbreeds. Problem is, as soon as you've unwittingly stocked these hybridized fish, you stand no chance of maintaining a healthy, pure Crucian population. I put down the receiver and immediately ordered a copy of Peter's superb book, Croc of Gold, which is to date the only book dedicated solely to the Crucian carp. But I had an awful feeling. If the entire nation and many of our top anglers had been so easily duped with crossbred fish, then what was to say every Crucian I'd ever caught was not an imposter too? Days later, with Peter's book spread across my thighs, my fingers hovered nervously over several digital folders filled with photos of fish. Gradually, I began clicking my way through my catches past. The princely brace from a recent visit to a farm pond were clearly just brown goldfish. They looked like crucians, but the scale count was way over. I went back further. The surprise two-pounder from a Newport commercial in the depths of winter. Oh, it was glaringly obvious now,